In 2013, when my company was already quite large and, you know, many hundreds of people working there, we had one of our factories in Park Royal in Northwest London. And I got an alert on my phone, which often happened when anything bad happened in the company, but it said that our communications link had gone down, and it was the 5th of December, so in Christmas peak season, where we're running at 120% capacity. And it turned out that thieves had gone into the area and pretended to be BT workers and cut through cables in the area to steal copper. But they cut through our primary and our backup fibre. And BT told us that it would be 4 days to fix it. And we said, in 4 days, we'll be dead.
Oh, God, that was so needed after that code red of a start. Speaking of code reds.
Yes.
Is there one that comes to mind?
There is. In 2013, when my company was already quite large and, you know, many hundreds of people working there, we had one of our factories in Park Royal in Northwest London. And I was at a school event in the evening, and I got an alert on my phone, which often happened when anything bad happened in the company. But it said that our communications link had gone down to this Park Royal factory, and it was the 5th of December, so in peak Christmas peak season, where we're running at 120% capacity. And I went home, talked to the ops team who were in Paris dealing with the issue, even though it was a London outage, and kind of reassured them, even though I couldn't fix it myself, and said BT will come out and fix it, and stupidly stayed up for most of the night while we were waiting for this link to be fixed. It never was. And it turned out that thieves had gone into the area and pretended to be BT workers and cut through cables in the area to steal copper. But they cut through our primary and our backup fibre. And BT told us that it would be 4 days to fix it. And we said, in 4 days, we'll be dead as a company. We can't. And so I assembled effectively a war room at 6:30 in the morning on site, all the leadership team, all the people around the company we could find. And we just explored lots of ideas of, can we get satellite trucks? Can we get a backup link put in? Somebody who came from the broadcast industry contacted his satellite truck suppliers, but Nelson Mandela had died the night before. And there were lots of people going out all around the UK interviewing people that had a connection with Nelson Mandela. So that didn't work. To cut a long story short, we bought about 40 hard disks and had couriers riding around London collecting data from various other locations, bringing it back. We cobbled together this stuff to keep running as a factory. And then in the afternoon, myself and the manufacturing manager went out in the car. We found the place where they'd stolen the cable and where the fiber break was. And we then found a BT engineer and we bribed him to fix it. And he did. And we were down for 36 hours, not 72 or whatever. But it was, yeah, the most stressful time. I didn't sleep for 2 days. But that was just indicative of the, in a way, what was happening all the time in our company. And we got used to it at scale, that disasters happened to be really big when they happened. So, yeah, that was one that sticks in my mind.
Wow. Does it still feel like as big of a disaster looking back?
Well, it was, because it was one of those existential experiences. You know, you realize that if you let down tens of thousands of people at that time of year, they're never going to come back to you again. And it would, you know, probably make the news if a company screwed up that badly in peak season. I also didn't mention that same week we had a cable break in the North Sea that took down our primary website because a submarine had dragged its anchor through it. We had a fire in our French factory, and we had an asbestos breakout in our London HQ, which meant we all had to go to a Regis for 3 days. So, and that was all 1 week. And I remember about 2 months earlier than that, somebody said, we really need to update our risk register of all the things that we could go wrong. And I said, I'll do it. And I wrote this, you know, 20-page document. And in that 1 week, half of the things I'd forecast all went wrong at the same time. So, that was a peak code red week, but there were many, many others along the way.
Wow. Yeah. What lessons did you take from that week?
there was nothing really that you could learn from that week. It was, I mean, one of the minor things was don't stay up all night when an event is in its early stages, because if I'd had a good night's sleep, I would have been much fresher the next day to deal with the aftermath. So that was one thing. I think code reds were a big thing for me. My pulse would run at 150 continuously while we had some kind of massive outage. And all you can do is start asking the right questions, assemble the right team, have somebody responsible for fixing, somebody responsible for communicating. There's a real kind of art for dealing with crises, and nobody taught it to me, and I certainly didn't do it as well as I should have, but I did learn tricks along the way to cope. And some of my colleagues said, God, you know, you're always fighting off a disaster, and I couldn't do it. But I didn't feel like I had any choice. You know, you fix it. You can't go home until you fix it. So, it happened a lot.
What did you learn about the art of crisis management? I think one lesson came through that you have one person facing the problem, one person communicating to the company or the public. Anything else comes to mind?
Well, stay calm. If you start panicking, everybody's going to panic. Make sure you communicate with everyone, like the leadership team, possibly the investors, the board, you know, but obviously customer services. What do we tell customers? Yeah, communication is so important, even if it's just like, we think we're getting closer, but when it's not fixed yet, that's a good message to send through. You know what it's like on the tube when the tube breaks down and nobody says anything for 10 minutes. You think the driver must know something. Just tell us something. And I think that was a really key thing. But yeah, just don't switch off that part of your brain that is there to solve problems. You know, don't get so panicked that you're not trying everything that you could be trying. And your setup here was a good practice for that. We kept going until you got this machine recording, and we just eliminated everything that could be wrong until we got to the thing that was wrong, right?
Yes, I definitely tried to stay calm under the pressure. I was running through all the options of what on earth do we do if this doesn't work. But you are the one that came to the rescue with all that experience, so I appreciate it.
The other thing is that when something like that's happening, there's a lot of personal physiological changes that are going on. You get hot all of a sudden, and you want to shed clothes, and you want to open the window, get fresh air. There's, you know, your body goes into this fight or flight mode, and you have to listen to it, right? If you sit there boiling, you're not going to have your best thinking hat on. So you have to listen to your body as well and respond to the physical needs as well as the mental challenges ahead.
Mm. The thing I normally do is I pace. I get very fast, and I'm like, something has to happen. I have to dethink it.
If it's the kind of crisis that isn't right in front of your face right now, it's something you need to think about and think through. Going for a walk, going for a fast-paced walk around the building while you're thinking things through is a great way to be creative and to come back with a plan, which is what you want to do.
Mm. Well, I appreciate your patience sitting here for a good 10 minutes while we tried to figure out the problem. We jumped into it, but I would love to take a moment to let the audience know who you are and what's important for them to know about you in this stage of life.
So my name is Graham Hobson. At the time of this recording, I'm 59. I've had a long and fun career that started out in technology, and I worked for many financial institutions for several years, including the London Stock Exchange and three investment banks. And in my mid-30s, when I had two young boys with my wife, I decided to start my own company called Photobox, and that was a very long and painful journey. And I guess it's why I'm here today, because I stuck with it for 17 years and it worked as a business. It became a much larger business. And I realized I'd got so many things wrong during that journey and discovered so many things about myself that I didn't know before. And then I've had several years since then to reflect on the journey, to go and work for somebody else and to work with lots of other companies. And the success of that journey has given me the freedom to choose how I spend my time. And so I get to do things now that I enjoy and that I feel help other people. And I'm a very positive person and I really enjoy life and don't let the stresses impact me too negatively. So yeah, that's me.
Don't let the stresses impact you too negatively now or throughout the course of the career?
I think on balance through the course of the career, I always had the upper hand on them. But it didn't mean they weren't there. I recognized that they were dragging me down at times. And at one point they put me in hospital. But that's the entrepreneur's journey in a way, I think. If you're lucky enough to be in a long cycle of the journey as an entrepreneur, you're going to have some really low lows and some really bad stresses and a burnout. People often talk about burnout. The ones that are lucky enough to have the long journeys also have the burnouts. So that definitely happened to me. And I think at the time it felt kind of impossible to get out of and almost inevitable. But looking back, I realized there were so many things about my lifestyle at the time that I was doing that didn't help me resolve it easily. And I spend a good part of my hours every day now self-care and doing the things that I know keep me healthy in mind as well as body.
Was burnout what put you in hospital?
Yes. Yeah. This is 2007, so I'd been in my own company for 7 years. We definitely entered a new phase of European expansion. I'd changed my role from CEO to CTO, and I'd naively promised an impossible project. And when I was a few months into realizing how difficult it was going to be to deliver and how much the weight of expectation across the company was on me to find a way to deliver this, I just got further and further into stress and, you know, badgering people to deliver what we weren't really giving them a good steer on. And I was just constantly stressed. I just felt like my pulse wouldn't slow down below, you know, 130, 140, even when I was sitting in a chair like this in the evening. And at one point it was crippling, and I checked into A&E and I called my wife and I said, they're keeping me in for observation. They're checking if I've had a heart attack. And it turned out it wasn't. It was panic attacks, but they were unstoppable. And I could feel them coming on for days at a time. It was like a really slow wave hitting me. And there was nothing I could do to calm it down. The realization I got to over time was, don't promise something that's impossible. Actually have honest conversations with the people you have made the promises to about what to do next. Actually, my CEO was brilliant. I think I tried to resign, and he said, no, not having you resign, but I want you to take time off and clear your head. And when you come back, just evaluate it as a completely new job with a new set of goals and tell me what you would like to commit to and what you would like to reject. And so kind of rethink the plan from square one. And that was a really good methodology, which I use myself a lot now. But also it was the realization, get good sleep, have a good diet, do some exercise, have some time to de-stress every day, which are all things that come to me now very naturally, but didn't when I was a frantic founder in a fast-growing business.
You mentioned slightly earlier that burnout is part of the entrepreneurial journey. Does it have to be?
I think I've heard far more entrepreneurs who've been on a long journey with a fast-growing company that have told me they've had some form of burnout than ones that have said they escaped without any dips or any mental stress incidents. I hear it as a more common story than not. So I don't think it's inevitable, but I think it's, you know, there are several things about characteristics, I think, that are common to entrepreneurs. We all have this self-belief, sometimes dipping into delusion. We all have this manic commitment to getting stuff done and to almost defying disbelievers. And I think we all feel a sense of personal responsibility to make sure it works. And with the right guardrails, all of those things are incredibly positive. But when they all collide and things aren't going quite as well as you hoped, I can see how those characteristics drag us down.
So now looking back, how would you balance the optimism and the realism?
Maybe I'll answer that by talking about what I think are the most important qualities for an entrepreneur. I think you've got to have a passion for the problem you're solving. You've really got to believe in the product or service you're offering and what it's trying to achieve. And for me, it was very basic, right? I had young children at the time and I was taking lots of photos, and I wanted to take pictures with a digital camera and choose what we printed and ultimately have better quality pictures that I could share with people or give them prints from. And that was a really important problem for me as a, you know, with a young family. And I believed in it, and I believed that everybody should have access to that solution, and it didn't exist at the time. And the reason I mention that is I think lots of people look for a problem to solve, but when they build it, people are a bit meh, or, you know, even you can detect even the founder themselves is not that fully bought into it, but you have to have that passion. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that you have to have a large amount of resilience and adaptability to be an entrepreneur. You have to deal with constant failure or setbacks, and you know you're never going to get it right at the beginning. So you come up with this vision for what you're trying to do, and there will be many things around funding or people or disappointing results, disappointing sales that set you back, and you have to have the resilience to go into work the next day and come up with a new solution. And what are we going to try next? And that adaptability is you've got to deal with everything that happens and just come up with a new plan. And you've got to be all in as well. I think it can't be a side gig. Ultimately, you know, once you're doing something at scale, it's got to be your future does have to be on the line, right? If it's optional and you think, if it doesn't work, I'll go and do this instead, then you're never going to commit to it. And the other thing that's very important is I think we have to have a bias for positivity. And I'm just trying to remember what was the original question you asked me. How do I balance optimism and
realism?
Realism, yeah. And the other thing that's very important is I think we have to have a bias for positivity. I felt I was deluded often when I was on my journey, that I believed that this company was going to work and it was going to prosper and the customers were really going to love our products, when there was absolutely no evidence for that. And I think you have to be positive. So we are very positive creatures as entrepreneurs, but you've got to be realistic as well. So I think you've got to believe it's always worth continuing and there's always something else we can try, but also don't keep flogging a dead horse and, you know, pushing a product that nobody's buying or pumping more marketing money into a product that hasn't really achieved product market fit. So, I often think that realism comes from external advisors or external conversations. I think it's okay for us as entrepreneurs to be ultra positive, but we have to be able to talk to people and then have them say, do you know, it's not really working. What are you going to try next? I think we have to be open to taking that input. And that was something I wasn't very good at the beginning, because I just didn't have those conversations.
And what did the lack of those conversations lead to?
In my own case, I was so focused and busy and working long hours that it meant that I became very kind of singular about the way I was building the business. And on one hand, I'm really pleased that we were very experimental with our customers, trying new products and services, seeing which worked and which didn't. But in the running of the company itself, I feel like I wasn't talking to anybody about how it was going. I had a co-founder. My co-founder, Mark, was absolutely brilliant and someone I could bounce a lot of ideas off. And I think because there were the two of us sharing the burdens and sharing the load, that felt like enough. But actually, we were in a bubble, and it would have been far better to get external advice. And we had a part-time CFO and we had a part-time chairman. So we did have a bit of that, but I wasn't really talking to peers and other people who were starting their own businesses at the time. And I think the net result of that was there were some decisions I made that could have been a lot better. And ultimately, it took us way too long to get to some kind of credible scale in the UK, literally 6 years. And if I feel like I'd had a healthier set of discussions with my peers and a bit more outside perspective on the company, I feel like I probably could have cut that time in half.
So what sort of conversations do you have with what sort of external people? Because I'm assuming you don't have every type of conversation with every type of person outside the business.
Yeah. I remember being so cagey about what we were doing with competitors or people in similar space. I think we had this ridiculous idea that if we told somebody a new product we were about to try or a new service we were thinking of or just some insight we had, they would immediately steal our idea and we'd lose some edge. So we did all these kind of daft things. Obviously, some of them worked really well and some of them created great growth for us and advancement for us, but a lot of them were complete dead ends. And I feel that if I talked to people about what we were thinking of, what we were trying, and they gave me their perspective on it, and maybe they'd said, yeah, we tried that, that really didn't work, I could have saved myself a lot of time. I also wasn't talking to other people in startup communities about funding. And one of the things we never did for the first 6 years was raise any professional investment from, we had some angels at the beginning, but we didn't raise any more money after the first, you know, 3 months of running. And I think if I talked to people and they said, oh yeah, I'm talking to this VC and I'm talking to that VC and I just raise money over here, I would have thought, what am I doing? I should be raising money. You know, in a way, even though we had a small business, we'd achieved everything we'd set out to in our first phase of growth. And I could have gone to a VC and raised money. But instead, Mark and I were being so conservative with our cash flow and trying to do everything out of revenue. And so that just hampered our growth. And like I said, it cost time that I, you know, in looking back, was wasted time.
It's really interesting because the bootstrap mentality is now praised a lot more heavily, given that it feels like there have been lots of companies that have raised off maybe shaky foundations.
Well, these things go in cycles. And when I came up with the idea for PhotoBox in late 99, because I bought a digital camera and literally couldn't get prints anywhere, and wrote a short business plan. It all sounds very professional now, but I was working in tech and I was on the tube every day and I just thought, how would I solve this problem? And I ended up writing this, I don't know, 12-page document or something about how I would go about it and started to talk to people. And they said, and this is 1999, which, were you born then?
I was.
You were, just.
I was born in 96.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. Same as my oldest son. So 99 was this period of very rapid growth in technology and internet investment. And Cisco was like one of the hot stocks. And Amazon had probably been launched in the UK for about a year at that point. And tech was so hot and the NASDAQ was at all-time highs. And all you had to do was say, I'm thinking of starting a website or I'm thinking of starting this online business, and people would give you money. And that's what happened. I walked into work. I was working at Merrill Lynch and I walked into work and I said, yeah, I'm thinking about starting this online business to print photos. And people said, well, if you do it, we'll give you the money. And I think I was trying to convince Mark to join. That was a long conversation. But after about a week, I thought, yeah, I'm going to do this. And I went back to the people and said, yes. And within a week, I had £500,000 in a hastily opened NatWest bank account. And I remember thinking, I could be like written about in the Daily Mail as a complete fraud. I've written this 12-page document. I've opened a bank account. And I've got £500,000 in it. And now what? You know. But that was the time that I started, and people were throwing money at me. I was turning away friends and family who wanted to give me money and saying, "No, no, no, I don't want to raise any more than that." But about a month after we launched the business in May 2000, the Nasdaq crashed, and the general consensus were B2C businesses were a terrible idea. They were never going to deliver on their promise. So the order of the day was bootstrap, cash preservation, you know, fire everybody you've just hired and eke out an existence on a very low funding level. And so we got our burn down to, I can't remember, like 12 grand a month or something. And we were, you know, measuring weeks to live. And that cycle lasted about 2 years, which was similar to the amount of time the recession lasted in the UK. But what I didn't do was see the inflection point where suddenly the markets were open again, funding was open again, B2C companies weren't considered that bad, and then ride that up with funding. We just stayed in this cash preserve mode. But you're right, these cycles still happen. You know, 2 years ago, people were throwing money at tech businesses. Then over the last year, it's been very difficult to raise money. Now the markets are just starting to open again. So yeah, it's all cyclical.
And so the lesson I'm taking from this is ride the wave, whatever that wave may be, whether it's bootstrap, whether it's raise, go with the flow.
Yeah, and because I wasn't talking to people who were in the startup community, I didn't get any of those signals about where we were and what our options were. And in a way, you know, we had brilliant advice from our part-time CFO and part-time chairman, who were brilliant people who opened so many doors for us. And our chairman in particular was very well connected in the photographic industry, but they weren't tapped into that startup mindset and VCs. And so that was a trick that should have fallen to me to fix.
Fundraising is one of those, is one of the two things that almost everyone seems like they have challenges with. One is, or everyone has to do, one is hiring and the other is fundraising.
Yeah, I don't have any secrets for fundraising, and people often ask, can I introduce them to angel investors or VCs? Or and the answer is no, rarely, because, you know, like, everybody's trying to hire, and I can phone up some VC I know, but so what? But what I, the way I can help is I know what a good deck looks like, and, you know, I've seen so many decks that sometimes, at some point in the last few years, people were sending me like five a week, and I would always look through them just to see what's going on. But you can tell the difference between a good deck and a bad deck. A good deck covers all your basic questions. Does this company know they've built a product or service that somebody wants? What's the problem they're trying to solve? Is that a scalable problem? Have they had early traction? You know, is it either survey results or early sales that show that there's demand and they've got something there? Are the unit economics healthy? Do they have an ambitious plan that could take them through the next 3 years and show some kind of 10x return potential for angels? And you know, these to me now feel like quite basic things to address in a deck, but so many founders miss those points or take for granted that they know what they're doing. Why does the investor need to know all of those things? So, yeah, I often help people by just trying to craft that message. And in the process of them crafting that message, they can either figure out what's wrong with their business model or tick all the boxes. And then it's much easier to go and talk to people.
Generally, it comes down to keeping it simple, doesn't it?
Yep.
Amazing. I would love to touch on, go back to Photobox, specifically how the company changed over the 17 years and even more specifically, how the people side of the company changed over the 17 years. So you went from starting in 2000, mm-hmm. May 2000, and with just you and Mark.
Yes.
And then when you exited in 2017, what was the size of the company? How many people did you have?
About 1,400 people across all of the different brands in the group.
So one of the things that people talk about a lot is culture.
Mm-hmm.
what foundations make a strong culture?
Well, I suppose I would, what is culture? Because when you're starting, when you're doing a startup or you're in a small business, you don't think about culture explicitly, because it's like a fish thinking about water. You're just in it, right? And it's, for me, in retrospect, what is culture? It's a shared set of values and behaviors that define how one is expected to operate in the company. And you don't need to state any of that explicitly when you're a small company. If you're like under 30 people all in one location, there's no point, right? Everyone can see the founders sitting there in the middle of the floor and how they talk to people and how they approach sales and talk to suppliers and talk to customers and how they treat their staff and how they run customer services. All of those things are explicit and therefore don't need to be written down. People just learn by observing how it works. If someone is rude to people or treats them with disrespect, then we exit them, then people learn, well, we don't do it that way. So you don't have to write it down. But when you get to like 50 people and you're not in the room all the time, you're out on the road or you're on a different site, then it's really important to start to define what we're about. And some companies are, you know, explicitly about money, profit, high growth. Maybe they're in an industry that's a bit of a zero-sum game where in order for them to win, somebody else has to lose, and they're fine with that. But for me, it was, I just think I've always been a fair person. I'm quite an introvert and quite shy when I was younger, and I never kind of went in all guns blazing in any situation. I'd be very tentative and try and understand what would make this person want to, you know, grant my request and be polite. And I tried to carry that into the business. And I found that the more that we treated the people we were dealing with respect and in a way left something on the table, you know, like don't always try and secure the best deal, just do something that makes both sides happy, it worked for us. And it might mean that we paid slightly above the odds for supply of something, and it might mean we gave away a bit of margin to a customer that was unhappy or just, you know, asking us for a discount or something. But if we treated people nicely and with respect, I think it served as well. And so that was the main element of the culture we were trying to teach at the beginning, and our way of dealing with people fairly and responsibly and always delivering value, even if it means it diminishes a bit of what we're getting out of it.
I love that. It's a much more holistic view, a lot more collaborative as opposed to competitive almost. Mm.
That's not to say, though, that I felt that we had a great culture as the company grew. I became increasingly aware over the years that our company was very top-down in terms of management. We were making a lot of big decisions in a room with a small number of people. And a lot of our team, particularly our technologists, felt under enormous pressure at times to deliver things that were hard. And I think that I am not a natural people and culture person. I found it very difficult to switch from being the person who was trying to get stuff done and trying to advance the company to worrying about people and their emotional needs. On some levels as a personal person, you know, in my personal life, I'm quite good at being empathic and understanding when somebody is upset or needs help or, you know, is struggling. But I was, I guess, so driven myself at work. I was a bit intolerant of people that were, I don't know, asking for more emotional support at work and things like that. So I feel I was a tough and demanding boss who was probably over direct at times, particularly in technology management. And that contributed to an emergent culture that was quite harsh. And that's my retrospect on it.
So what characteristics do you have to bring to the two different scenarios? You have the problem solving, getting stuff done, and you have the people management?
I think when your company gets larger, you have to realize that the thing that drives you as a founder or as a leadership team person, the incentives you have are very, very different to the people you hire as employees. And we convinced ourselves that, you know, our overall vision or mission and share options and things like that and working on cool tech were enough incentives for people to do their best work. And I realized that most people just wanted to come to work and get paid. That's the, you know, primary goal, get paid, pay the mortgage, hopefully work on stuff that was interesting, meet some fun colleagues, right? They don't care about the mission or the vision of the company really, or that's what I felt at the time. And, you know, when I would say, come on, you know, like we really need to deliver this massive project and it's going to make a huge difference and it'll, you know, maybe increase our revenues by 20% if we can break into this market. They don't care about that stuff. And so I think we should have put more effort in early on into making sure that we could find that sweet spot where we create a great working environment for our employees, where they're fairly paid and they enjoy what they're doing and they're driving us towards this goal or vision that we have as a company. But they're two different sets of goals and incentives. They have a sweet spot in the middle, but not, they aren't the same thing. And I think I didn't recognize that enough at the time. And actually one of the contrasts was we bought Moonpig in 2011, and I'd known Nick Jenkins for years, and we used to print things for them and they used to print cards for us. And we'd even jokingly talked about putting the company together in 2006 or something like that. But it took a long time, and eventually we bought them. And on the surface, they're quite similar companies. They're both driven by emotion, and they're both personalized print. And it's all about making a connection with somebody, you know, marking a birthday or an anniversary or just celebrating your family by printing a beautiful photo book or a canvas or some nice prints or sending them a birthday card or flowers. They're all connected, but two very different types of market. And so it made a lot of sense for us to put the two companies together. But when we did, we realized that they had a totally different culture to Photobox. And the managing director of Moonpig at the time, not Nick, but the guy who worked for him, used to go around every desk at 6 p.m. turning off people's computers and say, go home, you know, go out in the sunshine or go home with your family. And we had more of a kind of hard work mentality. And they tried to make things a lot more fun at Moonpig. They even had pigs that would come into the office every Friday, little micro pigs. And they'd all go cycling together across Europe and raise money for charities and things like this. And I just realized, okay, that's culture. They're putting a lot more work into it explicitly, and we weren't. Their office was a lot cooler. We ended up actually moving into their office, basically taking over the whole building and in retrofitting their culture into ours. And I can't say it was a, you know, instant success, but it we definitely went in the right direction. And yeah, we had a culture transplant.
Let's assume that the people we're talking to are earlier stage than an M&A situation, but maybe they still need to change their culture. How, if you knew the importance or the impact that a really strong positive culture would have had on Photobox before you bought Moonpig, how would you have gone about implementing that?
I think, you know, like many things, it comes down to honest conversations. I think if we'd given some of our employees an opportunity to talk with maybe an independent person in the room, like family therapy, you know, if we'd all sat on a sofa and they'd said to them, what is it about working at Photobox that pisses you off the most? Or what is it about the behavior of the leadership team that, you know, most stresses you out, in a safe space to answer those questions? And, you know, to the leadership team, what is it that you get most frustrated about delivery from the team or the way that the company culture is evolving? I think if we'd had a chance to have those honest conversations, we would have surfaced a lot of stuff. Maybe not all of it was fixable, but a lot of it would have been. And we didn't do that. You know, when we were larger, we started doing these monthly pulse surveys, which was a kind of internal NPS of, you know, based on your experience of working here at Photobox, how likely would you be to recommend Photobox as an employer to friends or family, and scoring it, you know, 1 to 10 with an NPS type score, you know, way of subtracting the detractors from the fans. And that was a really powerful mechanism. We could definitely see dips in particular teams corresponding to events that were going on, maybe a cancelled project or a deadline approaching that they didn't feel good about or something like that. We would see dips, and that was very useful because we could see a red light and we could go in and intervene and say, come on, what's going on? What can we do to improve this? It was definitely good to get that kind of feedback, again, at a larger scale before people started quitting. But again, we could have done that at an earlier stage as well when we were, you know, a company, a startup, all in one building, one room.
So then how do you approach the responses to those pulse surveys? You said the detractors, you have the fans, you have people whose motivation fluctuates depending on the external situations, i.e. like what projects they're working on, whether something's been pulled or not. Were there any processes of intervention given different results?
I suppose when it happened, when we were a larger company, it would be to the manager of those teams, go and talk to them, find out what's going on. And, you know, often once the numbers were there, it was relatively easy to say what's causing this. Why are your team so stressed at the moment? What would make it better? I think also I was, you know, quite a stressed, driven, single-minded leader at the time. And I probably would have got very defensive if people were telling me that me setting arbitrary deadlines wasn't working for them. So having somebody in the middle who's not too emotionally invested in either side would be a good way of surfacing the issues without it getting tense.
What sort of leader would you have liked to be?
Oh, well, just someone who's effortlessly good at motivating people and conveying a vision. And, I think my technique worked better with some teams than others. I had a data science team in Paris at one point when neural networks were very new and we were starting to analyze people's photos and figure out some themes and trends and propensity to do things. And I felt like I was just being myself with them, the usual kind of driven, hey, what can we do this? Drawing it on a whiteboard, can we do that? And they'd say, yeah, sure, we can do that. And then they'd go away and come back a week later. And I'd say, that's great, let's do this next. And for whatever reason, my kind of single-minded focus worked really well with that type of team. It didn't work so well with people who needed more, I don't know, more nurturing, more reassurance, more praise. I found it very difficult myself to celebrate success, but that's really important for people because, you know, in my mind, I was always thinking like three steps ahead of, but we need to be up there and you want me to throw you a party because you're down there. but people needed that. And I think, you know, you're either good at people and culture or you're not. And I just accepted I wasn't. So in a way, as the company grew and we started to bring in more people in more specialized roles, that was good because some of those areas got covered better than I could cover them. I mean, as an entrepreneur at the beginning, when you're under 10 people, you think you're the best person in the room to do everything. But obviously at some point you start hiring people who are much better than you at marketing or technology or sales or whatever, customer service. And they know their stuff so well and they just get on with it. And you think, I couldn't do any of that. And obviously that trend continues. You know, eventually you get to a point where you realize you're adding no value at all because everybody else is so much better at the job than you are. And that's the normal stepping off point for a business you create.
Requires a lot of self-awareness, which requires us to zoom out of being in the weeds and feeling stressed to get things done all the time.
You only have to have self-awareness of one thing, which is, am I adding value? Am I in that interaction, in that meeting, in that planning session, in that project, did I add value? Did I do something that the outcome depended on? And that's quite a scientific evaluation. You don't need to be very emotionally connected to judge whether you've added value to something. And over time, the natural way of things is that you're adding less and less value because the company and the organization are adding that value.
I'd love to rewind something that you said earlier, which is about how you had very high expectations of people. Some people respond to that, some people don't.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the rockstar entrepreneurs that we've all heard of tend to have quite unreasonable expectations of people and push them hard to achieve them.
Mm.
However, that requires potentially quite a big lack of empathy. How do you think about the balance between pushing people hard and having very high expectations of people, but then also being realistic or being empathetic and kind?
It happened quite a lot. And I think it's something that you realize that you can only get away with a few times. The more you demand exceptional bursts of energy or creativity or effort from people, you're using up some goodwill. And in my mind, I was thinking, well, I'm pulling all-nighters when things go wrong, or I'm stressing about this project and I'm thinking about it all weekend. So, you know, if I'm doing that, then why can't you? But again, it comes down to there's a very big difference in incentive and potential outcomes for the founder of a company or the leadership team and somebody who's just there to get paid and have a good time. But sometimes I would push people because we had some big deadline coming up and there was a big, you know, new phase of the website or new product coming out, and I really, really pushed. And I think sometimes that's justified, and we all felt good about the fact that we pulled out the stops and, you know, got something done. But then when it hasn't quite worked, or it's not the outcome you hoped for, it's very difficult to ask for that next time. Yeah, there are times when it really is important for people to focus and pull out all the stops, but you have to ask for that very sparingly.
Was there anything that you remember doing that built that goodwill that you could then tap into when you needed?
I think when incentives are aligned, it's a good way. You know, when they recognize for them working on it, it's also good. Although for some reason, cash incentives never work with technology people. I don't know about other teams, but we did try, you know, cash bonuses at one point when we really had some tough deadlines. And I don't know why, but they just don't work. Technologists get less motivated when you bribe them with cash. So
BT people, however, do.
Yeah, BT people do, yeah. But I think it comes down to the kind of quality of the mission or the vision of what you're trying to deliver. If somebody really feels like they share in that vision, then they will push hard to get stuff done. But it's really difficult. I mean, in retrospect, I think that a lot of the challenges that we had were just too hard. We were working with a tech stack that was overly complex and had too much legacy in it, and we hadn't really evaluated the tools and our approach, and we were doing things that were like wading through treacle. And I think it's difficult to solve that problem. What we should have done is thought about why is this so hard? Are there simpler ways to get to where we're going? So I think, again, that lack of external communication, of peer discussions, of brainstorming completely different approaches to things, I just didn't do enough of that for quite a lot of the time. And, you know, thinking back, I feel like there were 3 or 4 monumentally bad technology decisions I made that made the company much more complicated and expensive and slow to grow than it could have been. And you can't kind of wake up every morning thinking I screwed up, because clearly, you know, we got to a good outcome. But I just realized that I put myself and so many other people through so much hard work without really thinking, was there a faster way to get there? And that's something that I reflect on. You know, you said earlier, you know, keep it simple. And actually, sometimes the simplest solution is the best way. But when you're in a business and it's growing, everything starts to get very complicated, and you assume complexity is you know, a natural thing that you just have to accept. And often you don't. We bought a company in Germany towards the end of my journey at Photobox, maybe in 2015, 2016. And they had, they were selling products quite similar to ours in Germany, photo books, calendars, large format prints. And they were doing about 40 million euros in sales. And they had a tech team of 7 people. And I think we had a tech team of more than 100 at the time. And I asked them why was their team so small? And they said, well, basically, we just kind of buy in, use third-party solutions. You know, we use Post-it notes or Excel spreadsheets. We just, you know, do the simplest solution to get the customer what they want and try and focus our technology on just like 10% of that problem space where it's really needed. And I just realized that's it. That's what you need to do. You know, don't try and reinvent the wheel all the time. And so the learning from that was keep it simple, keep the team relatively small if you can, and ultimately just, you know, deliver value to the customers. And we went down this big team complex route.
Yeah, wow, which then ties into the difficulty of managing lots of people.
Yes, yeah.
Really interesting. Could you share a story of one of these big near-death experiences?
Well, you've heard about the cable cut. Well, I think they felt like they were constant. Of course, that whole time period now, that 17-year period is compressed down into a kind of 5-minute sped-up movie for me now. So I'm sure there were calm periods, but it felt like we were constantly on the verge of some kind of disaster all the way through, running out of cash within the first 3 months, having an investor promise us £1 million and that never getting delivered, and us having to scrabble for cash just to keep the company alive, going through the doldrums of small business mode, running out of cash personally. I mean, I had a good career before Photobox, but I'd used up all my savings and sold my car and remortgaged my house. And I remember my parents bought us a car when we had a third son, because we needed a bigger car. So that on the personal level, you know, my wife was incredibly patient. I think we did a lot of things right in 2005, 2006 in negotiating to suddenly raise more money and merge with a European company. But then committing to a project in 27 that ended up me being in hospital and I couldn't deliver at the time. I mean, the project was called Babel, which should have been a warning sign, right? It's about man's hubris and ultimately being cast into the wilderness, unable to speak to our fellow men. That's the name of the project. And it just ended up being this undeliverable beast. And again, I just made wild commitments, which kind of worked for the first 6 years. But I didn't have any experience of agile or what people would understand now as a collaborative way at arriving at estimates and planning and team size calculations and duration calculations. I just said, yeah, give me like 10 people and 9 months and I'll deliver this project. And it just didn't happen. And, you know, eventually it did 2.5 years later. And that was kind of disappointing, but it that was a terrible phase. And then, you know, we were growing fast across Europe and there was a really interesting, fascinating period for me, learning about scaling companies and growth levers. But then I think also we got very distracted in the last few years I was there, focusing on how are we going to get a return for our investors, because they've been incredibly patient, but maybe put more attention into that and less on product development and evolving the technology and the customer experience. And so I feel like that that was something that I could have done much better as well. But yeah, all through there were a constant string of code reds that always felt like the end of days. You know, if our website went down for several hours on a busy evening, that was very stressful. And obviously for customers, it could be thousands of customers across Europe that were suddenly frustrated and said, we're the worst company in the world. What else happened? I remember one day I was, again, in a pre-Christmas period. I was big on monitoring, always looking for data that would tell me that, you know, all the indicators were green. And I saw this number building up of orders kind of being held in a queue. And it was like 10,000 orders and 15,000 orders and 20,000 orders. And I was talking to the team in Paris saying, what's going on with this? And they said, no, it's normal. It's just, you know, orders waiting to be processed by the factory. And I said, I don't think that looks right. And anyway, it turned out that some system had collapsed under the weight of processing and just given up the ghost. And then suddenly we realized that these orders were going to miss the deadline for Christmas and that we didn't have enough capacity to suddenly burn through all the backlog. And so then you go into this kind of disaster management mode where you're, okay, how are we going to chop this up so we get them through, and how are we going to contact the customers, and can we expedite shipping? And so you get one thing wrong and then suddenly it becomes the activity that dominates the next 2 weeks, and you're doing nothing else but trying to fix the aftermath of that problem. So yeah, many experiences like that.
Wow. I love the sort of humility and responsibility that you talk about all of these events in a very long journey. And then you go from struggling for cash, what sounds like constantly throughout the journey, to then having a huge exit in 2016, right?
Yeah.
Which is just phenomenal. And like any entrepreneur would be happy with the sale that you managed to pull off. So, I mean, in retrospect, does it feel worth all that time and stress and energy?
Do you know what? I think we're kind of driven to do the things we do. And I started the business because I wanted the service. And I must admit, you know, in those heady days of 1999, the idea of creating a business that had value and could provide financial security for my family was a factor, for sure. I think after the first few months when the markets all went south, it was that was less on my mind. It was just about, let's do the best possible job we can do at building this service that people love and want to use. And you do all of the things you can to make that a success, and like I said, to deliver value and to follow the course, the path laid in front of you to get to a good outcome. It wasn't about getting to an exit. And by the way, an exit for people is not the same as an exit for the company. The company carries on and most of the people stay in the company and do what they're doing. The exit is primarily for the early investors and sometimes for the founders, but not always. And so we were very aware of our responsibility to make sure that those VCs that had backed us in 2006 got a return. But also we knew that as founders, we were going to participate in that as well. So it was a great personal result for me. By the way, when a company is said to exit for more than £300 million, it doesn't mean the founders get that, right? All the investors that have put money in get their money back. And often the founders are diluted down to a much smaller amount at that point. But nevertheless, it was, you know, a great result for me personally. And I remember that day of, you know, checking my bank balance, and it was suddenly this number larger than I'd ever seen before. And my bank phoning and saying, what's going on? You know, why have you just had this amount deposited into your bank account? You know, that's great, because you think, okay, I've, you know, in one way, on a financial scale, I've won. But what does that really mean? You know, like, everything I've been working for the last 17 years, you know, have to keep going, have to go into work every day, have to kind of help grow the company because I have a responsibility to my employees and my investors and my family. And in a way, once those boxes are ticked, what do you do next? And so you have to pick your next mission. And for me, it was, I want to retain the memory of why we started the company. So I actually stayed on a year after I got paid off, because we changed half our leadership team. We had new investors, and I wanted to remind everybody about the customer, you know, the typical customer who would order online and with her family photos, and she'd be buying it as a gift or a photo book for the house or some art for the walls, and just reminding them that's why we're there, to serve that person. And I didn't want that to get lost in kind of corporate private equity financial models. So that became my mission for the next year. And then it really did feel like a stepping off point. So I had to think, well, what am I going to do next? And for me, it was about decompressing for a few months and having some spare time and going traveling with my family and clearing out the attic and doing lots of boring things. I think I had a to-do list of 60 items that were the most boring things in the world, as well as, you know, go to Japan and spend some time in Paris and things like that. So, but yeah, it's a new phase, and you have to just attack it like a new problem to be solved.
You've touched on quite a few times your family in this. You've been married now for almost 30 years.
Yep.
Three sons. And you've spent 17 years working extremely hard. In photo books, what was the impact of one on the other?
So I met my wife in a tech company in the late 80s, and she was in sales. But when we started to have a family, she said she would stay at home and mind the kids. And I said, look, it's your choice, right? I don't mind. We can find a childminding solution. My parents were alive at the time. There were lots of options. But she wanted to focus on the boys. And in a way, that made things much easier for me, because it meant I could completely focus on the business when starting that and put in longer hours. And, you know, she said to me at times I was home, but I wasn't home, because I'd be on my laptop after eating and dealing with customer service. And you know, Mark and I shared all the roles at the beginning, you know, printing and taking stuff to the post office and doing customer service at the weekends. And so it was a big commitment, and I was stressed quite a lot of the time. So I don't discount the impact it had on my wife and my sons when they were young. And there's this mindset when you're in an early stage business, you kind of think, I'm going to put off all of those things and I'll address them when it's successful. You think of this future date and you imagine, you know, the company's grown and you're paying yourself more money and maybe you can afford to move to a slightly bigger house. And you always think when we get to that point, that's when things will be great. And after 6 years of this mode for me, I realized that point may never come. So I have to kind of start focusing on my young family now, be more present, because you can't keep putting it off. So yeah, I think it was tough on them. And maybe at the time, I didn't appreciate how tough it was, but yeah, we've had some honest conversations in the years since, and I understand my wife's perspective now. My sons are, you know, we're a very close family. In fact, until a few weeks ago, there were six adults living in our house because our three adult sons were living at home and one of their partners was living with us as well. And it was great. You know, it wasn't quite the ideal of everybody cooks once and, you know, one day a week kind of thing. But we had a really fun time and it was enjoyable. Now two of them have moved out to East London, but there's still four of us in the house. And we're close as a family and we enjoy things together. But my sons are all very different. One of them's a scientist, one of them's an artist, and one's in the middle. And, you know, it's a mixture of myself and my wife. But I think that they sometimes show signs of being, you know, proud of me and my slightly OCD, slightly ADHD approach to life. One of my sons has a friend who is a, you know, wannabe entrepreneur and has come up with a few product ideas. And my son thinks it's not going in the right direction. And he said, I keep telling him, just book a coffee with my dad and he'll tell you what you need to do. So they see me as the person that kind of gives good advice from the outside. And if that's how they think of me, that's good. That's a positive thing.
I love that. Conscious of your time. So I'd love to finish with, are there any lessons that you've taken from family life and applied them to business life or vice versa?
Well, my wife has always had a much stronger EQ than me and spends minutes and minutes thinking about her text response to friends and how many emojis to put into it and will take half an hour to think about what to write in a birthday card, whereas I'm like three lines and it's done. But I do understand the balance and that sometimes it's important to take a breath and not just get a task done as quickly as possible, but think about what is it that person expects from you, from that relationship, and what are they expecting to hear? What would comfort them or what would make them feel good? And so I think I've always been used to kind of trying to deliver value, but on a very transactional level. And she reminds me it's important to make people feel good as well as getting what they expected from it. My sons, like I said, they're very different to each other and they're different to me. And I find it interesting to observe them and how they organize things. My oldest son, who was born the same year as you, is an actor and writer and sometimes director. And he loves what he does with a passion. And sometimes I feel like we live in two circles that don't quite meet in the middle, with just totally different mindsets. But then sometimes he has such emotional intelligence he shares with me that show me that he's completely on top of any situation that's going on, and he'll often drop in the insight that I'm missing. I just realized that we're tied by family and by blood, but sometimes you can dismiss people's views because they think very differently to yourself. But actually, it's important to embrace diversity of opinion. In fact, there's a great book I read once called Rebel Ideas by Matthew Said, and it's about how it's important to surround yourself by people that think very differently to you, because you have a much wider view of the problem you're trying to solve. Then if you hire clones of yourself, you end up with a very limited view. That works in family too.
Amazing that you've learned that, because family feels like the place where that lesson, that's the most difficult pill to swallow there, when you expect that they're going to be as like you as anyone will be. And so therefore, why are they not thinking about this problem in the same way that you are?
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I assume.
Yeah. I think I have a very specific view of the world that, you know, I have a tendency to treat everything as a technical problem to be solved. And and some things that works well for, like fixing your recording deck, but not so much, you know, human relationships. And I think I've got better over time at recognizing when different skills and different solutions are required.
Not everything's a nail.
No, exactly. Precisely.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time. It's been incredible.
My pleasure.
So much. And yeah, I love your reflection on your journey and how open you've been. And yeah, it's been very rich. So thank you.
Thank you.